Welcome to the Other Earth podcast. My name is Daniel Apay. My guests today are Dr. Nick Siegler, Chief Technologist for the NASA Exoplanet Program Office from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, and Dr. Sean Domagal-Goldman, an astrobiologist working at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. We are meeting here at a hotel on the shore of the San Diego Bay today, where we are attending a meeting hosted by the NASA Exoplanet Exploration Program on the future of the field. This is a really exciting meeting where scientists, engineers, and managers discuss ideas and technologies that will enable us to search for life beyond the solar system. This was also a great opportunity for me to interview Nick and Sean, two of the key players in the field, about their vision of the future. So Sean, you are an astrobiologist with the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. You are one of the few people who are truly interdisciplinary and touch on so many disciplines. And you are also represented in so many different committees and different communities that are interested in searching for extrasolar planets. So how did your career unfold? How did you end up at the Goddard Space Flight Center? How did you get interested in this?
So I got interested in astrobiology pretty much the first time I heard about it. I think I was reading a book called The Case for Mars by Robert Zubrin, who's talking about humans colonizing a red planet. And I remember myself being really interested in one of the reasons, one of the motivators for doing that, which was that we'd send astronauts there to search for life. And so as an undergraduate at the University of Rochester, I found the one person, Ariel Anbar, that was doing astrobiology research, and started working with him. And then I decided to go to grad school for astrobiology, starting out thinking about how we might look for signs in rocks that would tell us that life was there in the past of history of Earth or on Mars. But eventually, you know, when I heard that there was a prospect of doing it on these extrasolar planets, these planets around other stars, I fell in love with that concept from the get-go, both because there's so many different planets out there we could explore with such a wide variety of things to discover that we haven't discovered yet. But also there's the potential for, you know, walking, talking things to be present on those worlds, and doing podcasts and stuff like that. And that potential is just awesome. And so, I've really been just fallen in love with the whole concept. And the thing that is special to me, especially now being at NASA and being involved in these committees, which sounds really boring, is I actually have to pinch myself because these committees are doing things like saying, how are we going to apply the scientific method to the question of, are we alone in the universe? This is a discussion we could have had over beers for centuries. This is the first time we can have that discussion on PowerPoint slides at science conferences. And our generation is going to be the ones that have those slide decks presented at science conferences. That's cool. That's, to me, that's what gets me to stay up late at night and to get up early in the morning and work on very little sleep and lots of caffeine, because I think we're the first generation in human history that'll be able to do that.
Yeah, very cool. So that's basically brings me to Nick, whose work at JPL is to actually develop technologies that will make this happen, right? And it's a very challenging task because we are developing technologies that we don't know how they will work, to apply them to systems we don't know what their properties are. To search them around planets or stars, we don't actually know whether they, which are the right targets. So, Nick, what's your role and how do you manage these tasks?
So, I am the program chief technologist for NASA's Exoplanet Exploration Program. So, it's my team's job to identify which technologies will enable these important capabilities. Right. So, what's important for us, as Sean was mentioning, is that for us to discover evidence of life on these exoplanets, the technology is not necessarily the measurements, although that's very important, but it's actually being able to see the planet light. If you notice that, rarely do we ever see the planet. In fact, 90% of all the exoplanets that have been discovered to date have all been discovered indirectly. So to be able to detect signs of life, we actually have to see these planets, and the technology is all about something called starlight suppression. Said more simply, the ability to block the brilliant light of the star and image the reflected light of the planet. That ratio can be something like 1 to 10 billion times fainter. Very hard.
I mean, I'm often amazed by the scope of these missions, right? To make something like Hubble or James Webb's Space Telescope
reality, there are in James Webb there are about 10,000 people working on the mission. That's actually very similar to the number of people that used to build the pyramids. It's a major project, very ambitious, built over many decades, and of course one has to plan in advance where the field will be moving. And with exoplanets, that's a topic that has been emerging so quickly, much quicker than the missions have been catching up. So, Sean, would you tell us where we are in terms of exoplanets or understanding of exoplanets? How much have we learned? What do we know now?
Well, so as Nick said, almost everything we know about exoplanets come from in what he called indirect observations. We see the effect that the planet would have on the host star as the planet orbits around the star. And what that means is it's actually limited what kinds of information we get about that planet as well. Mostly we know about the orbital properties, how far the planet is from the star, how circular the orbit is if we're lucky, and we know how big it is, either how big it is in terms of volume and radius or how massive it is or how heavy it is. If we're really lucky, we'll know how massive it is and how big it is, and we can get some very preliminary guesses at what that says about the planet's density and therefore its composition. But really all we have right now for 90% of the targets is astrophysical information. We don't have chemical information yet for most of the planets. Just for a small handful we do. And that's what actually you mentioned James Webb. Webb's going to give us that chemical information and start a new era of thinking about extrasolar planets, not just as physical objects, but as ones with chemicals in their atmospheres. And that will then help develop the technologies as well as some of the telescope beyond that, WFIRST. Well, those will develop the technologies to get the better observations that Nick was talking about before, to let us directly image these extrasolar planets so we could look for signs of life and think about their biological characterization. So I think of sort of three phases. We're ending the era, or we're at the peak of the golden era of the physical and astrophysical characterization of these worlds. We're just about to start the era of chemical characterization of these worlds, and we're just planning the missions and the technologies that would bring about the biological characterization of these worlds.
And if I could just add to that, in terms of what folks have perhaps not learned about exoplanets, that's something that only we as scientists have learned just in the last 2 or 3 years, and I think they'll find this fascinating. And a lot of this has to do with the success from NASA's Kepler Space Telescope. One, we now know that planets are bountiful. Our galaxy is teeming with planets. We always suspected that based on our understandings of how stars form, right? But we never actually knew that as a fact. So now we know statistically that every star that your listeners see in the night sky have at least one exoplanet around it. And that's probably on the pessimistic side. There's probably a whole planetary system around every star that we see in the night sky. So when you look at the night sky, you might think of it a little bit differently now. Right. The second thing we've learned is that planets like our own Earth, in terms of size, are roughly the most common type of planet, somewhere between 1 times and 2 times the size of our Earth. That is absolutely something that wasn't even predicted back in the early days, right? So the fact that the most common type of planet is not too far away from our own, boy, that's exciting news. And then the last part is that these planets that are similar in size to our own Earth, we are finding them at distances from the stars where water can actually flow in lakes and ponds. So all these things pieced together bode very well for the possibility of life springing up there like it has here.
And the other thing that we've learned is we found these things that we had no idea that would be out there. In fact, in some cases, we predicted that they wouldn't be there. Hot Jupiters, super Earths, circumbinary planets, right? These are planets where we've smashed together words that meant things on their own, but were never placed together before. Mm-hmm. Like flux capacitor from Back to the Future or something, right? Like that. And we've had to smash these words together to make new words up, because they're describing things that we thought either that we didn't know of before, or we actually predicted would not be there. Mm. And when you think about that in the context of what comes next, the chemical characterization and the biological characterization of these worlds, that's where it's even more exciting, because it's like now we're talking about getting surprised not just about planet properties, which that's exciting enough, but getting surprised about what the composition of planets is in the universe, or getting surprised about what the biological composition or entities are on these worlds. Right. I mean, in some ways, it's the stuff that we don't expect in those in these future discoveries that I'm the most excited about. Mm.
So from NASA's perspective, we now know that the galaxy is teeming with planets. So the next step has to be, as Sean mentioned before, characterizing these planets for signs of life. That is absolutely the next endeavor.
And turning it into a testable hypothesis, right?
What do you mean by that?
So instead of just saying, you know, the universe is teeming with aliens, saying the universe is teeming with aliens, and here is the scientific test that we could apply to that statement. Hmm. That's what is, like, different.
I mean, statistically, right, I think you and I are incredibly optimistic from a statistical sense that there is life somewhere else in the galaxy other than Earth.
Right.
But the problem is we haven't proven that yet.
Right.
So until we prove it, it's just, you know, two guys having a beer.
Yeah. So how could you prove that? How could you find life?
Well, actually, it's kind of the interactions that people like Nick have with people like me, you know. So you know, I'm a theorist. And so I'll go and I'll talk to my colleagues from a variety of different disciplines to figure out what would constitute evidence of life on another planet that you would believe from your disciplinary perspective. And so that could be a biologist, it could be a geologist, it could be an astronomer. They're all going to look at that question from different perspectives. And what we're trying to do is try to get all those people from those different perspectives into the same room to come up with some consensus data, something that would look like evidence from their discipline's perspective. And if we can get all those scientists to agree on that, then I can go to someone like Nick and say, hey, Nick, here is the standard of proof that the scientific community has that they would accept as evidence of life. And then Nick says, okay, here's all the challenges on the table to obtain that evidence. And then he brings together a bunch of a different kind of scientist, a whole other realm of scientists and engineers, to get to work on that part of the problem.
And, you know, I wish we could see these aliens easy, right? We would love to see flying saucers and Battlestar Galactica type of spacecrafts. The odds are we won't, because these planets are very far away.
It's and we're not counting on it.
And we can't count on it because
right.
we'll be here forever waiting for it. So the approach is going to be one of probing the atmosphere of these exoplanets, looking for evidence of gases that are potentially consistent with life either as we know it or so bizarre that it might be related to life as we don't know it.
So you basically really look for life changing an entire planet, right? So isn't that crazy? Would that be something that we would see on Earth?
The way I think about it is there's a very enmeshed relationship between biology and the planet that it lives on. And by the way, the star that planet orbits is a part of this as well. You almost have to think like a bacteria or like a suite of bacteria growing on a planet and say, if I were a bacterium and I were living in that planetary environment, what would I do to make a living? What would I do for my energy source? Right? We're all animals that respire. So we eat pizza and breathe oxygen and burn those things together for our energy sources. But plants and algae, they'll use photons from solar energy to make their living. Other bacteria might make methane. These are the bacteria that live in the guts of cows or in rice paddies. So if you hear the joke about, you know, methane comes from cow farts, actually it doesn't come from cow farts. It comes from bacteria that live in the guts of cows, and the methane gets released when the cows fart. But you know, so I think about it. What would a bacterium do in that environment? And if I can predict that a bacterium would do the thing that I'm seeing in that planetary atmosphere, and I can also rule out non-biological ways for that thing to be produced in that in environmental context, then I think I've got a really good argument for biology being present on that planet. And essentially, you say, what would biology do if we're on this world? It's doing the thing we see. And can I rule out non-biological processes doing that same thing? But it is about both the thing you think life is doing and the context in which it's doing it.
Yeah, and what's fascinating is life, at least life here on Earth, leaves an imprint in the atmosphere
right.
of its planets, of its planet. Mm-hmm. So, for example, to be more specific, oxygen is a classic example, right? I mean, oxygen, we need oxygen to live. And oxygen is created mostly by photosynthesis, which is another living creature, right? So the fact that we have oxygen in our atmosphere reveals the possibility of life, but it's not a slam dunk. There are other sources of oxygen that maybe have nothing to do with life. So we need to piece together this puzzle. So we probe the atmosphere for not just oxygen, maybe other interesting gases like water vapor, mm-hmm. right? Methane. And any one of these discoveries would be fascinating, right? It'd be compelling for life, but it wouldn't be a slam dunk that we have concluded that we found life. But when we piece together the different discoveries, the different gases into a puzzle, and piece that together, it starts to tell a story. And then we can use experiments either here on Earth or on our computers to simulate what could have created this. And sometimes you back out, the answer is like, holy crap, you know, this had to be something that was biological.
You mentioned that we found so many planets with Kepler, right? And many of them are in the habitable zone. So they receive enough sunlight to have the possibility to have liquid water being stable on their surface. How come we cannot search for life on those? And you mentioned starlight suppression. What are the ideas? How could we search for these biosignatures in the future?
All right, so again, looking for these imprints of life requires us to capture the light just from the planet and not the star, right? So really, it's something called occultation, mm-hmm. if you will. So for those of you that have had the rare privilege of seeing a solar eclipse, right, that's when the moon crosses in front of the sun. And then you see features alongside of the sun that you would never see unless you had that. Well, we try to do something very similar with these planets, but it's not something as big as the sun. But it is sort of like sticking your thumb in front of a very bright light source. But it's a lot more complicated.
The analogy I often tell people is like if you've ever tried to track like a baseball or a soccer ball or something in the sky or a plane in the sky, and it goes too close to the sun, your detectors, your eyeballs, get overwhelmed with the sunlight because it's mm-hmm. so much brighter than the thing you're trying to track. And that's essentially the problem that we have, except it's the star and the planet are, you know, light years away.
Right.
So you also have to be able to, you have to build a huge telescope or a large telescope to collect photons from that really faint thing, and then essentially throw out a lot of the photons that would otherwise be in your field of view because they're coming from the star and not from the planet.
Right.
The systems that you guys are thinking about are really amazing, and they will basically take probably 20 years to build or so in the largest scales. So it's a true visionary challenge that we are facing. So let me ask you this, if everything works well, where would we be in terms of understanding extrasolar planets, and especially Earth-like planets around other systems, 25 years from now? So say around 2040, what would we know? What would be the coolest thing that we would know, and what would be the questions we would want to answer next?
So I'm going to be a little bit conservative here in how aggressive I say what we're going to find. Because part of this is, the whole point of building it is to find out what's out there, right? So I think in 25 years we'll be in a place where we will have either found evidence of biology on a planet around another star, or have searched so exhaustively for it that we know that life is rare in the universe. I can't tell you which one of those outcomes we're going to get. I can guess. But the cool thing is we're going to be in one of those two worlds 25 years from now. And the other thing I'll point out with the 25 year question is, I know there's going to be some college students listening to this, 25 years from now you're going to have more experience under your belt than either Nick or I do, or Daniel for that matter, at our points in our career right now. So you could be one of the lead scientists on that mission if you put your nose to the grindstone and work hard on the problem for the rest of your career. But you know, you got time to join the team even if you're young.
Now I'd like to think that in those 25 years or so, that, you know, it's not beyond the realm of possibilities that we could also be contacted, right, with our radio telescopes.
Yeah.
We've all seen the movie Contact with Jodie Foster. You know, that approach is absolutely reasonable. It's just that there are so many channels, we don't know which channel the aliens are on.
It would make our target selection for one of these future telescopes easy, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. So I'd like to believe, and I know I'm sounding a little fantastical, but I would love to think that in that time span that we will put together a very formal program to probe the atmospheres of hundreds, if not thousands, of exoplanets. But in that time frame, it'd be nice to know that we would be contacted.
So, and let's be optimistic for a second. We're going to have this telescope in space then But the other things we're going to have is we're going to have samples hopefully returned from an icy world in the outer solar system that'll probe whether or not water is a sufficient condition for, and the interaction of water and rock is a sufficient condition for the origins of life in general. There's a different, fundamentally different philosophical question that kind of astrobiological experiment is doing. And let's assume we're also going to have humans and having put footprints on Mars that have brought samples back from the red planet, or potentially rovers and robots that have brought samples back from the red planet, potentially both, that will have looked for evidence of life in the history of Mars as well. I mean, we're talking about a world 25 years from now where we've looked exhaustively throughout and beyond our solar system for evidence of life.
But you know what's challenging, though, is after we start getting our first evidence of these biological potential gases in the atmosphere, we may not know if that's simple life or complex and advanced life, right? That's going to take another series of tests and technologies. We're not there just yet.
Right.
So one other cool aspect that I'm excited about when exploring other planets that are more similar to Earth is that they provide a context for better understanding our planet. So what's how much can we learn, and what does this tell you? What would we learn from, say, having 15 or 20 Earth-like planets and understanding their properties?
So there's two answers to this question that I think are equally valid, right? I think there's one answer that says we only have one example right now, one data point of an inhabited planet.
Mm-hmm.
And that means we don't really know, we don't have a fundamental theory of how biospheres work. We have a fundamental theory, we're developing one, on how our biosphere works.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't really develop a fundamental theory of life or the interaction of life with its host planet based, or of anything, based on one data point. And so we're going to learn a lot just from having more data points to look at. And even if we find nothing, we'll know more about what makes Earth and the Earth-Sun system special to have been the one place where we do know of life. Well, because again, we'll have looked exhaustively at all these other data points and ruled it out and say, okay, what's weird about, what is Portlandish about Earth that makes it weird enough to host life? And now the other thing is, I think that before we understood the planets in our solar system and their chemical compositions, this is just an example looking back in history, we didn't understand certain things that we understand that have influenced our understanding of our home planet. And, you know, we talk about the greenhouse effect a lot, right? Like, just look at Mars, Earth, and Venus, and you can see dramatic differences in the temperatures of those planets. It's not just because of how close they are to their star.
Mm.
It's also because of how strong of a greenhouse gas effect there is on those three worlds.
Right.
And with Venus, we also know that there's specific chemical things, not just related to the greenhouse effect, but the chemistry that led to the ozone hole on Earth that we've now started to repair on our planet. We found that out because we found similar chemical reactions occurring in the Venusian atmosphere and Venus's atmosphere at the same time. There were these corresponding mysteries on Earth and Venus that got resolved simultaneously. It's those kinds of... we would not have predicted that science return from Venus before we started observing it. So there's this unexpected nature to fundamental science that I don't know what benefits we're going to have 30 years from now from this work, because... there's going to be something we don't expect. That's kind of the nature of science and research, right? Isn't that Einstein's quote? You know, if we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be called research, right? Like if we knew what the answer was, it wouldn't be worth building the telescope.
So that brings me to another question. So not only is research exploring other planetary systems, but on the way to reach that goal, to be able to study these planets, we are also building technologies that don't exist today, that, as you mentioned, Nick. So are those technologies useful for other purposes too? Or what part, if any, does that technology really translate to everyday life?
Well, that's a question we get a lot. And what's fascinating about fundamental research is we never know where it's going to take us, right? I think Michael Faraday, who's one of the inventors of the concepts of electricity and magnetism, he didn't actually understand the power that it would have. And our planet has been transformed from that fundamental research. So in our journey of developing the technologies that will lead to the discovery of life elsewhere, I don't know what other applications we will come across, but I'm certain that there will be some that will be practical. I will say that for one of our two technologies that we call the coronagraph, there are some really sophisticated optics that goes into this instrumentation with mirrors that move that you can't even see, almost at the atomic level. Certainly, I suspect that there'll be some perhaps biomedical applications as we advance these technologies.
So this progress is really changing our life in the long term, and which is very exciting. So I'm sure that some of the people who listen to this recording will be wondering about, especially younger people, how could they become engineers and managers, technologists at JPL, or astrobiologists working for NASA? So what advice would you give to them, Sean?
I think for me, the main thing is, if you love the top level question, of are we alone or what are exoplanets like, pick another question that you love, right? Because you can come at that from a whole bunch of different angles. You can be someone that helps manage programs and budgets. You can be someone that is involved at the engineer and technology level, at the science level. And even at the science level, you can come at it from astronomy or chemistry or biology. So find something else that you love to do on the day-to-day. It might even, and even to the level of I love computers and I like writing computer code. So what that has translated into is I love the science and the theoretical aspect of things. So I'm a person that writes computer code to simulate the chemistry and geology of these other planets, and I apply those questions to the broader question of are we alone? And I say that because life is super competitive. Even if you're not a competitive person, just the nature of the job market is super competitive. And that means you're going to have to work really, really to be able to be successful and to get a job and to pay down a mortgage eventually and all that mundane stuff. And working hard is a lot easier if you love what it is that you're doing. Not just on the broader question, but you have to love the nitty gritty detailed stuff. So if you're passionate about this, that's great. But find the stuff you love to do on the day to day.
What I would add to that is, this is almost a strategy of employment and careers, but there are treasures to be found at the boundaries of disciplines, mm-hmm. right? So you can mix some of the craziest disciplines, for example, medicine and atmospheric science, right? You'll be surprised.
That's a thing.
Yeah. Just trafficking in those boundaries of those intersects has been so rewarding for astrobiology. In fact, yeah. Astrobiology,
astronomy and biology.
Yeah, it's like, peanuts and butter. I also fell in love with astrobiology because I was and still am very ignorant about things outside of my field of expertise. So, and that goes across the boards in finance and in engineering, in teaching, and all across our society.
Thank you very much for the great conversation and for joining me.
Thanks for talking to us.
That was great.